Welcome to Hub History, the show where we share our favorite stories from Boston history. This is episode 55, The Boy Fiend, Boston's youngest serial killer. Hi, I'm Jake.
And I'm Nikki. This week, we're going to discuss a Victorian-era serial killer who stalked the streets of Boston. He predated Jack the Ripper by a decade, and the Boston Strangler by almost a century. The killer, however, was a child. Jesse Pomeroy was known as the Boy Fiend, a child who tortured and killed his fellow children, becoming Boston's youngest serial killer. Just as a note, as you might guess from the topic of the show, we will be describing brutal acts of violence against children this week. If you listen with kids, you may want to pre-screen this episode. And if that's not your thing, maybe you should rejoin us next week. Before we talk about our third serial killer in just over a year, it's time to take a look at this week's historic site and upcoming event.
Today, Squantum Point Park is a popular spot for dog owners to stroll with their pets, and for fishermen, birdwatchers, and beachcombers to try their luck. It's about 45 acres, located on the Quincy side of the Neponset River, right at the mouth where the Neponset Estuary meets Boston Harbor. There's a large grassy field ringed by walking paths, and it's surrounded by scrubby forest on all sides. At the very tip of the point, benches face across the river to Boston with views of UMass Boston and the Dorchester gas tank. Around the park are several major developments, including a large warehouse for Boston Scientific, a marina with boat storage, and the Marina Bay mixed-use development with houses, apartments, and restaurants. If Squantum Point is a peaceful place to birdwatch today, that belies the peninsula's history with the U.S. Navy. If you had visited during World War II, you'd be more likely to see a Douglas Dauntless dive bomber or a Grumman Hellcat fighter than to spot a cormorant or a coot. From the 1920s to the 1950s, Squantum Point operated as a Naval Reserve airfield. When it was opened in 1923, it was actually the first airbase in the Naval Reserve program. The first airfield opened on Squantum Point in 1910 when the Harvard Aeronautical Society leased 500 acres of marshland, cleared a grassy field, and called it an airport. I forget that airplanes even existed in 1910, but by that summer the Harvard Aviation Field would play host to the country's first air show. On August 20, 1910, the New York Tribune reported on the upcoming event. No aviation meet held in this country, and probably none yet held in the world, has had such a representative list of foremost aviators as is assured the Harvard-Boston Aero Meet, according to the list of entrants to date, announced tonight. The entry list is international and includes 17 individual aviators and 11 types of air navigating machines. The latter embrace the three principal standard types, the monoplane, the biplane, and triplane. It'll be the first time the latter type has been exhibited in this country.
This may be a rabbit hole to avoid going down at the moment, because the 1910 Harvard-Boston Aero Meet probably deserves a future episode all to itself. Suffice it to say that the Wright brothers were there demonstrating their flying machines, and it appears to be the first time that the U.S. Navy seriously evaluated whether these newfangled contraptions could one day be useful in waging war. U.S. Navy Lieutenant C.A. Blakely was ordered to attend the meet, and during the maneuvers, you and the officers under your command will carefully observe and report on the maneuvers of the aeroplanes with particular reference to their possible utilizations as offensive weapons in naval warfare or as scouting machines. The Harvard Field hosted additional air shows in 1911 and 1912, but then the lease expired in 1915. For the next couple of years, an airplane engine company based in Hyde Park used the field for occasional test flights, but it was otherwise abandoned. When the U.S. entered the First World War, everything changed at Squantum Point. Bethlehem Steel's subsidiary, Bethlehem Shipbuilding Corporation, owned the nearby Four River Shipyard in Quincy. In 1917, the Four River plant was building submarines as fast as the shipyard could go, when Bethlehem got an order for 28 destroyers. The company took the contract, but needed a way to expand their capacity in order to fill it. Nearby Squantum Point was just on the other side of Quincy, with access to the harbor and the Old Colony Railroad. The Victory destroyer plant was ready to go by the end of 1917. By the end of 1918, it delivered 18 ships to the U.S. Navy. In its heyday, the shipyard at Squantum Point could build a destroyer in as little as 28 days. In all, 34 destroyers were built at the yard before it was decommissioned in 1920. While Bethlehem Steel was building destroyers on the tip of Squantum Point, the Massachusetts Naval Militia erected a small seaplane base on the sheltered Dorchester Bay side of the peninsula called the Massachusetts School for Naval Air Service. It served as a training ground for Massachusetts planes for a few months before the U.S. Navy took over both the seaplane base and the old Harvard Aviation Field in May of 1917. U.S. Naval Air Station Squantum only operated from May to September of 1917, training pilots for the basics of flight before they were shipped off to other facilities to finish their training. After the Navy moved and consolidated their pilot training facilities in late 1917, the airfield at Squantum Point was largely forgotten again for a few years, until it was rediscovered by Richard E. Byrd. Byrd would go on to become a rear admiral in the U.S. Navy and flew many pioneering polar exploration flights, claiming to be the first person to fly over both the North and the South Poles. However, in 1923, he was just a young lieutenant and Great War veteran who loved to fly. He took over the old seaplane hangar and the airfield and established Squantum Point Naval Reserve Air Station, the first of its kind. For the next 6 years, it would again serve as a training base for Naval Reserve seaplane pilots.
In 1927, Naval Reserve Air Station Squantum got a neighbor. Not even a mile away across the peninsula, a civilian airport called Denison Field opened up under the direction of an enthusiastic young aviator named Amelia Earhart. Then in 1929, Squantum got its own landside operations when a turf airfield was opened for the first time since the Harvard days. The base was expanded throughout the 1930s under the direction of Commander John Shea, who would later be killed when the USS Wasp was torpedoed by a Japanese submarine in the Solomon Islands. A letter he wrote to his 5-year-old son, John Jr., was published in the Globe after his death, titled, A Letter to Jackie. We'll have a link to it in the show notes, and we challenge the listener to read it with a dry eye. Under Commander Shea's watch, many hangars and support buildings were added, and the runways were extended and finally paved in 1941. On the eve of World War II, the reserve base was activated, becoming Naval Air Station Squantum. Throughout the war, Squantum Point was used for Marine Corps and U.S. and British naval pilot training, but it also served as home base for a number of active duty squadrons. They flew anti-submarine missions patrolling New England coastal waters, long-range convoy escort missions, and supported carrier-based squadrons as needed. After the war, the base was used for a time as part of the new Reserve Training Command, but it was quickly becoming obsolete. The newest Navy planes were bigger, heavier, and more powerful than ever before, and they required longer runways than Squantum Point could offer. Not only that, but it was located right across the mouth of Boston Harbor from Logan Airport, and the increasing amount of civilian air traffic led to increased conflicts. In 1949, an Air France flight crew even mistakenly landed their Lockheed Constellation airliner at Squantum Point, after confusing it with the civilian airport. Finally, in December 1953, the base was closed. The last plane to officially take off from Naval Air Station Squantum was the commanding officer's twin-engine Beechcraft SNB, as all the aircraft were transferred to the Naval Air Station at Weymouth. If you visit, look for a granite relief map of Boston and its surroundings embedded in the concrete at the very end of the point. The modern shoreline of the city is superimposed over the original 1630 map, showing just how much of the city sits on made land. There are also a number of interpretive plaques about the site's aviation history. There's no admission fee to visit, and there's ample parking for a small fee. You can also get there by ferry from Rose Wharf or Fan Pier. If you're a runner or cyclist, consider wrapping a visit to Squantum Point into a longer outing. The park is the eastern terminus of the Neponset River Greenway, a mixed-use rail trail that now stretches from Squantum Point about 8 miles upriver to Paul's Bridge, which is only steps from the Blue Hills Trail Network. On the other side, Squantum Point Park also connects to the Quincy Shore Path, with over 2 miles of harbor views. We'll have the fall ferry schedule, historic pictures, and links to more information about Squantum Point Park in this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/055.
And for our upcoming event this week, we want to highlight an author talk coming up at the Massachusetts Historical Society on November 27th. Dr. Henry Louis Gates Jr. is a Harvard professor and well-known historian and scholar of African American literature. He's credited with rediscovering and authenticating the two earliest known American novels by Black authors, and he's widely known as the host of Finding Your Roots on PBS. Maria Tatar is a Harvard professor and expert in children's literature. Together, they have edited a new volume of children's stories called The New Annotated African American Folk Tales, which was published this month. Here's the description of their presentation at MHS. This new publication presents nearly 150 African American stories, among them familiar Br'er Rabbit classics, but also stories like The Talking Skull and Witches Who Ride, as well as out-of-print tales from the 1890s Southern Workmen. Arguing for the value of these stories as part of a sophisticated, complex, and heterogeneous cultural heritage, Gates and Tatar show how these stories deserve a place alongside the classic works of African American literature, and American literature more broadly. There will be a reception at 5:30, and the talk begins at 6 p.m. Registration is required and costs $10. Check out the show notes this week for a link to register. Now let's move on to our main topic.
April 24, 1874 was a spring day in Boston, and two boys from Southie walked down to the beach to dig for clams. They found that they had misjudged the tide, so they wandered down the shore. Pretty soon, they were exploring the salt marshes along Dorchester Bay, just entertaining themselves. Suddenly, a gruesome sight stopped them in their tracks. Lying on his back in a muddy ditch was the body of a small boy. He was still warm. The boy had been stripped almost naked and stabbed a total of 33 times. He had several stab wounds in his right eye, at least 6 or 7 in the chest, and more in his hands and groin. His genitals had been mutilated, and his throat was cut with such force that he was almost decapitated. The body was quickly identified as 4-year-old Horace Millen of South Boston. Police were able to backtrack Horace's footprints and a second larger set of tracks in the marsh mud from Horace's body to a wharf on Dorchester Bay a half mile away. At the wharf, witnesses recalled seeing young Millen walking hand in hand with an older boy, asking about some men who were shooting wild ducks out on the marsh. Edward and Benjamin Harrington had been on the beach not far from the murder scene. When police questioned them, they recalled seeing a young boy in a cap, unusually tall for his age, run away across the marsh. With that report, and the brutality of the killing, police immediately suspected 14-year-old Jesse Pomeroy. They only hesitated because they thought he was still safely behind bars at the reformatory.
Jesse Pomeroy was born in Charlestown on November 29, 1859. He was born with a cleft lip, which people less politely referred to back then as a hare lip. As an infant, his right eye was covered by a white film, probably as a result of a cataract. The milky eye would mark him as different from a young age and last his whole life. Pomeroy wrote an autobiography in which he describes what seems like a pretty typical childhood at the time. He lived with both parents and his older brother Charlie, and the family moved a couple of times within Charlestown. He didn't love school and would often play hook jack, as cutting class was called back then. He played baseball. He enjoyed accompanying his father to work at the Charlestown Navy Yard and watching him operate and maintain the dry dock there. Jesse and Charlie would go sailing on the Mystic River in spite of a prohibition by their nervous mother. They would fish out of the Mystic River and on Chelsea Creek. As a young adolescent, Jesse was not a very social child. He preferred to keep to himself and didn't spend much time with his peers. Whether it was because he tended to be withdrawn, or because he frequently got into trouble at school, or simply because of his appearance, the other children began to regard Jesse as slow. The opposite seems to have been the case, as he became an avid reader, devouring pulp novels and their tales of action and adventure.
When he was 12 years old, Jesse Pomeroy's life took a dark turn. On December 26, 1871, a group of men walking up Powder House Hill in Chelsea heard a noise coming from an abandoned outhouse. At first, they thought it was an injured animal trapped inside the old privy. When they investigated, they found 4-year-old Billy Payne inside, dangling from the rafters. His hands and feet were bound, and he'd been whipped with a rope until he passed out from the pain. The following February, a teenager asked 7-year-old Tracy Hayden if he'd like to go see the soldiers. The older boy led him to the ramshackle privy on Powder House Hill, tied him up, and beat him with a switch. Before leaving, the teenager hit Hayden in the face with a board, breaking his nose and knocking out some teeth. The assailant even threatened to cut his penis off if he told anyone what had happened. In May, 8-year-old Robert Meyer was taken to the outhouse and given more or less the same treatment. He was taken to the outhouse, whipped, beaten with a stick, and forced to say profanity while the older boy laughed.
The chronology gets a little bit confusing from there, but several more 7- and 8-year-old boys were taken to deserted spots in Chelsea. They were bound, stripped, and tortured in an escalating pattern of violence. Some had straight pins jabbed into their faces and genitals. Others had cuts slashed in their faces, and one had both cheeks punctured with a knife. After the teenager finished beating and slashing one victim, he forced the youngster to walk to a nearby marsh and wash himself in seawater, literally rubbing salt in the wounds. By the summer of 1872, the police had questioned hundreds of boys in Chelsea. They hadn't made any arrests, but they were able to put together an increasingly accurate description of the boy who was torturing young children. The press carried breathless accounts of the violence, like this one from the second attack in early 1872. Some months ago, a big boy decoyed a smaller one to an old house in the rear of Powderhorn Hill, where he stripped and tied and beat him in a most cruel manner without any provocation or apparent motive whatever. The fiendish brute has appeared again, for it can hardly be possible that the same villain should have an imitator. Some accounts called him a young demon, a youthful vampire, and a monster, but the nickname Boy Fiend is the one that stuck. After the torture of 7-year-old Johnny Balch on July 22nd, the newspaper carried a description of the boy torturer and offered a $500 reward for his capture. Ruth Ann Pomeroy read these accounts with a growing sense of dread. She couldn't shake the feeling that her son, Jesse, was the fiend that she kept reading about in the papers. She decided that it was a good time for the family to make a new start and moved from Charlestown to South Boston.
This move was a good thing for the children of Chelsea, but not so good for children in Southie. In his new environment, Pomeroy's attacks quickly ramped up in both violence and frequency. On August 17th, 7-year-old George Pratt was abducted, taken to an empty yacht, and beaten violently. His abductor stuck needles in his arms and bit chunks of flesh from his face and buttocks. On September 5th, a 6-year-old named Harry Austin was stabbed under each arm and between his shoulder blades, and his genitals were badly cut. Within the next 2 weeks, he would attack 6-year-old Joseph Kennedy and 5-year-old Robert Gould. Gould was found tied to a telegraph pole along the Hartford and Erie Railroad tracks. He'd been beaten, stabbed, and nearly scalped. Despite the violence of the attack, young Gould was able to add a key detail to the police department's description of the boy fiend. His right eye looked like a milky, childhood slang for a white marble. The police were now on the lookout for a teenager with one milky eye, and suspicion soon fell on Jesse Pomeroy, whose right eye was obscured by a white cataract. In his autobiography, Pomeroy describes how he first avoided recognition. At about the first day of August, we moved to South Boston. I, of course, had to change schools. So at the beginning of the school term in South Boston, I applied for admission at the Bigelow School, corner of E and 4th Streets. I was admitted. After I'd been at the school about a week or so, a police officer and a little boy came into the school, and he looked at all of us and said to the officer, "The boy isn't here." That little boy's name afterwards, I found out, was Joseph Kennedy. His object in coming there was to see if he could identify the boy who had assaulted him. He visited all the schools of South Boston, and you will take notice of what he said. The boy isn't here.
For reasons that we've never seen fully explained, on the way home from school that day, Pomeroy decided to stop at the police station where Kennedy was being questioned. He stepped inside for a moment, looked around, then stepped back out to continue on his way. Seconds later, there was a hand on his elbow. Just as I got up to C Street, the officer that came into the school that day came out of the police station accompanied by this boy and took me by the arm and said he wanted to see me at the station. I told him I had done nothing wrong and commenced to cry. I was so frightened. Jesse Pomeroy would be interrogated for hours, then woken up in the middle of the night and interrogated some more. In the wee hours of the morning, he confessed. In his memoir, he says that he did it in part to be allowed to sleep and in part to obtain a lighter sentence. The next morning, several of his victims identified him. A week later, Jesse was indicted for 6 of the assaults. He testified against himself, and his victims identified him in court. His mother and defense counsel argued that Jesse was unable to understand what he was being accused of. Jesse was still just 12 years old, and so after he was found guilty, the judge sentenced him to be incarcerated for the remainder of his minority, meaning the 6 years until he turned 18. He was taken to the Westboro House of Reformation on September 24, 1872.
Life moves on, and the boy fiend of Chelsea and South Boston had largely been forgotten when a little girl went missing about 18 months later. On March 8, 1874, Katie Curran went out to buy a notebook and never came home. John Curran quickly went to the police to report the disappearance of his 10-year-old daughter, but there weren't a lot of leads to follow. A child reported seeing a little girl matching Katie's description get into a carriage with a strange man. If you've been listening to our podcast for a while, you know that Boston at that time was a hotbed of anti-Catholic and anti-Irish bias. Many at the time assumed that the man in the carriage was a cover story, and John Curran had shipped his young daughter off to a convent without telling her mother. Pretty soon, the investigation was dropped. Then, 5 weeks later, Horace Millen's mutilated corpse was found in the marshes. Though a rough description of the suspect matched Jesse Pomeroy, and the sadistic torture matched Pomeroy's M.O., police were slow to connect the dots because many of them believed that Jesse would remain in reform school until he was 18 years old. They soon realized, however, that he was back in the neighborhood living with his mother just a few blocks from the Curran family. At Westboro, Jesse Pomeroy had been a model prisoner. He was well-behaved, studious, and he was even known to inform on his fellow inmates. When a guard accidentally left a gate unlatched, 99 inmates managed to escape, while Jesse sat in his room quietly reading. For good behavior, he was released on parole on February 6, 1874. He moved back in with his parents, taking up a paper route and helping in his mother's store. 1 month later, Katie Curran was missing. 2 months later, Horace Millen was dead. After Millen's death, Police Chief Edward Hartwell Savage realized that Jesse Pomeroy was out of the reformatory and ordered his immediate arrest. When he was arrested, there was a speck of blood on Jesse's undershirt and some blood near the handle of his pocket knife. There was marsh mud on his shoes, and police would later determine that the shoes were a perfect match to the plaster casts they'd made of the larger tracks left at the crime scene. Police took Jesse to look at Horace Millen's body and questioned him in front of it. "Do you know this boy?" "Yes, sir." "Did you kill him?" "I suppose I did."
Pomeroy would later recant this confession and testify to his innocence at trial. In the meantime, while Jesse sat in jail awaiting trial, his mother Ruth Ann's dressmaking shop and newsstand was suffering. It didn't take long for word to get around South Boston that the young Pomeroy had committed unspeakable acts, and neighbors no longer dropped by to pick up a yard of cloth or the evening paper. She was forced to give up the shop, and that July, the new tenant began renovating the building. While they were cleaning out the basement, the workers made a terrible discovery. Under an ash heap, they noticed a piece of brightly colored cloth. When they investigated, they discovered the badly decomposed remains of a small girl. The body had been stabbed and mutilated, and Katie Curran's parents were only able to identify her body from the clothes that she had been wearing when she disappeared. Confronted with the discovery, Jesse at first seemed completely indifferent. Only after the police arrested his mother and his older brother Charlie did he change his tune, giving another confession that he would later recant. He told the police that Katie had come into the store while he was working the counter. She was looking for a new notebook for school, and the general store down the street was out. Notebooks weren't something the shop carried, but Jesse immediately thought of a plan to get her down into the cellar and out of sight. The girl came into the store on the morning of the 18th of March and asked me for a paper. I told her there was a store downstairs. She went down and I followed her, and as she stood in the middle of the cellar looking towards Broadway, I ran up behind her, putting my left hand on her mouth, and cut her throat. After that, I do not remember anything till I was just sitting down in the water closet.
By the time Jesse went on trial in December of 1874, he had recanted his confessions to both murders. He would claim that a guard at the jail had given him enough details about the Curran murder to make a convincing confession. He insisted that he was innocent of both crimes, and his defense counsel would argue that he was not guilty by reason of insanity. All the evidence introduced during the trial clearly establishes the fact that at the time the homicidal act was committed, the accused was not responsible for the reason that his mind was diseased. Could a boy of 14 be in his senses and drag away a bright little child, the delight of his home and the hope of his fond parents, and, without any motive or provocation and with premeditated malice aforethought, cut, mangle, and murder him in cold blood? The lawyer, Charles Robinson, shook his head no. He argued that Jesse should be sent to an insane asylum, saying, "No crime will be deterred by the punishment of an irresponsible person."
After a 3-day trial, the jury deliberated for 5 hours and returned their verdict: guilty of murder in the first degree. In his autobiography, Pomeroy makes his opinion of the jury clear. A murder is committed. There is great excitement, the papers are full of it, and men read about it. The case is to be tried by 12 of the men in the county in which the murder was committed, and as the men can't help forming an opinion of the case or help hearing of it, as the very horses and pigs do, the result is that the 12 men who have formed their opinion, but are willing to change it if the evidence warrants it, are turned away, and their place is supplied by a set of human donkeys who are to say whether the prisoner is to live or die. 10-1, they say he is not guilty when he is, and say he is guilty when he isn't. It is a question in my mind whether the jury are not fitter to die than the prisoner. At the time, Massachusetts state law mandated the death penalty for anyone convicted of first-degree murder. Any person who shall commit the crime of willful murder, who, in the Supreme Judicial Court, shall be duly convicted, shall suffer the punishment of death. However, Jesse had just turned 15, and the crimes he was being sentenced for had been committed when he was just 14 years old. He was the youngest person to be sentenced to death in modern Massachusetts history.
After an appeal to the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court failed, the death sentence was upheld. However, William Gaston, the first Democratic governor of Massachusetts, refused to sign the death warrant. The public in the state was overwhelmingly in favor of execution, and they believed it was the governor's executive responsibility to sign the death warrant and set an execution date. The governor's council had the power to commute the sentence to life in prison. They voted twice against clemency, but Gaston would not change his mind. Pomeroy's fate became a political issue in the governor's re-election campaign, especially after Jesse made his first attempt to escape from prison. Gaston did not win re-election, but his Republican successor, Alexander Rice, wouldn't sign the death warrant either. Neither man could bring himself to send a teenager of questionable mental faculties to his death. Finally, Rice prevailed on his council to take an anonymous vote, and they voted in favor of commutation by a simple majority. Instead of death, Jesse Pomeroy now faced the prospect of life in prison. However, the order of the council took things one step further. Pomeroy was sentenced to life in solitary confinement.
On September 7, 1876, 16-year-old Jesse Pomeroy was transferred from the Suffolk County Jail to Charlestown State Prison. He wouldn't see the outside of the gray granite walls of the prison until 1929. Biographer Harold Schechter describes his accommodation at Charlestown. Though he would eventually be transferred to a somewhat larger space, Jesse passed the first decade of his sentence in what was little more than a sealed granite vault, a 7-by-9-foot cell with a few narrow loopholes high in the walls to provide a modicum of light and ventilation. His only furnishings were a little table, a narrow bunk, a metal wash pail, and a wooden slop bucket. The inner, solid iron door weighed more than 500 pounds. The outer door of heavy wood shielded him from the sight of any other living being. His endless, crushingly dreary days were all the same. He would rise at around 8 a.m. when the daylight leaking into his cell had grown strong enough to see by. At the height of summer, his cell was as stifling as a coke oven. But in the winter, it was so frigid that the water in his wash pail would freeze overnight. After breaking the top crust of ice, he would perform his morning ablutions, assuming that the rats hadn't made off with his soap chips and tooth powder. 3 times a day, a guard would slide his tasteless meals through a slot in the wrought iron door. The food was always the same: beans, brown bread, hash, rice, molasses, and a thin, flavorless soup with a few limp cabbage leaves or slivers of onions floating in it. His only beverage was a weak, barely palatable coffee substitute made of burned rye steeped in boiling water. His only human contact was with the guards who gave him his meals and took away the slop bucket, and with his mother, who was allowed one brief visit every 3 months. After his mother died in 1914, Jesse Pomeroy stopped receiving any visitors at all. Today, Jesse's sentence might be considered torture. The UN Special Rapporteur on Torture issued a report in 2011 urging countries around the world to limit the use of solitary confinement. Considering the severe mental pain or suffering solitary confinement may cause, it can amount to torture or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment when used as a punishment during pretrial detention, indefinitely, or for a prolonged period, for persons with mental disabilities or juveniles. Even those bleeding heart liberals at the Federal Bureau of Prisons have been working on a plan to reduce their reliance on solitary confinement for the last 5 years. In all, Jesse Pomeroy would spend 41 years in solitary confinement. For many years, only Robert Stroud, the Birdman of Alcatraz, exceeded Pomeroy's time in solitary, and that was just one more year. Last year, former Angola prison Black Panther leader Albert Woodfox set a new record when he was released from prison after spending 43 years in solitary confinement. Thomas Silverstein, a leader of the white supremacist Aryan Brotherhood prison gang, has been in a solitary cell since 1983 and holds the record as the longest current sentence in solitary confinement.
With nothing but time on his hands, Jesse dedicated himself to two pursuits: reading and attempting to escape. As long as he followed the prison rules, Pomeroy was given access to as many books as he could read, and he read widely during his years behind bars. He would write and eventually publish volumes of poetry. He taught himself to read Hebrew and German, though without human contact it was impossible to learn to speak either language. However, Jesse did not always follow the prison rules. Even as a solitary prisoner, he was expected to perform chores and labor under the penal code, and Jesse would frequently go on strike, refusing to participate in the required activities. More than his strikes, however, it was his attempts to escape from prison that would get his reading privileges revoked. The punishment book containing his infractions from 1877 to 1898 records the following offenses. 1877, November 9th, trying to escape, digging through cement. April 18th, cutting bars in cell. November 2nd, 1880, cutting ironwork of cell. 1887, September 4th, attempt to escape, cutting bars of cell door. November 10th, causing gas to explode in cell. December 26th, tampering with cell door. 1888, January 10th, digging in his room. May 29th, cutting cell door, having tools in his room. 1891, May 25th, cutting cell door. August 17th, attempting to escape, cutting bars in cell window. 1892, cutting cell door, attempting to escape. 1894, digging bricks out of the wall of a cell. 1895, cutting bar in cell window, digging around cell window. 1897, attempting to escape, digging a hole in the floor of the cell. 1898, cutting cell door.
Of his many escape attempts, the most consequential was the one on November 10th, 1887, that's recorded as causing gas to explode in a cell. In his boredom, he had noticed that the gas lamps in the corridor outside his cell were fed by a gas line that ran just over the outside of his cell door. Thinking he could use the gas line to blast through the 500-pound iron and oak door that kept him confined, he spent months using a scrap of tin to dig out the mortar from between the two granite blocks in his cell wall, hiding his progress with a paste made from soap. When he finally uncovered the back of the gas pipe, he slowly wore a hole into it using a sharpened piece of wire. It was like the Shawshank Redemption if Andy Dupree had been a depraved killer, and unsuccessful. When he finally pierced the gas line, the first part of the plan worked. He used a pipe made out of a sort of papier-mâché of newspaper, water, and bread to divert the gas to an area where he had loosened the mortar around the blocks holding the cell door in place. The plan was to force the gas into all the gaps, then blast the stones loose. When he finally set off the explosion, the west wing of the prison shook from its force, and guards rushed to Pomeroy's cell, where they found him crumpled on the floor. A couple of large granite blocks had been knocked loose while Pomeroy was badly burned. His already cataract-obscured eye was largely destroyed, and he was knocked unconscious for hours. As a notorious criminal, Pomeroy's prison experience was always newsworthy. His strikes, his studies, and his escape attempts were often carried in Boston papers. After the Herald published an account of his gas explosion, a reader wrote a letter to the editor expressing his great regret that the boy fiend didn't get his body through the wall so that the keeper might have had an excuse to shoot him and forever rid the world of him.
After 41 years, the state relaxed the conditions of Jesse Pomeroy's incarceration in 1916. He would be allowed to join the general population, though he showed little interest. The Commissioner of Corrections described Pomeroy at this point in his life. He engaged in no occupation, never participated in prison industries, and was seen as a gradually aging old man, nearly blind, with a tremendous hernia, standing about impassive and solitary, not taking part in any of the social life of the institution. In 1920, he took part in the inmate talent show, reading a 13-stanza poem he had written. A few months later, his first book was published, mostly poems, with a few short pieces of prose interspersed. By this time, he had outlived his mother, and soon he would outlive the judge, his defense attorney, the prosecutor, and all 12 members of the jury that had convicted him. By the late 1920s, he was the oldest prisoner in the Commonwealth, and he had served almost 50 years behind bars. In 1929, the state took pity on the aging Jesse Pomeroy. Pity that he neither asked for, nor desired, nor probably deserved. After 53 years in Charlestown State Penitentiary, the state decided that he was too old and decrepit to continue serving his sentence there. Pomeroy was to be transferred to the state prison farm at Bridgewater, where he could serve out the balance of his life in more comfortable conditions. Pomeroy was indignant. Through the years, he had always maintained his innocence, vowing that he would only leave Charlestown through a pardon or a pine box. Even on the eve of his transfer, he would say, "I'm going to keep trying for my freedom. Only death will stop me." Though it was unclear whether that meant he would keep pressing for a pardon or keep trying to escape.
That August, Jesse was taken by automobile from Charlestown to Bridgewater. He was 69 years old, and it was his first time outside of the prison walls since he was 16. Newspapers all over the country exploded in sensational coverage of the country's most famous convict. He saw his first elevated railway, a steam shovel, and wondered what happened to all the horses. He watched a plane take off, and the guards brought him a ginger ale and an ice cream cone. 1 hour and 43 minutes later, they arrived at Bridgewater. A few months into his stay at the Bridgewater prison farm, Pomeroy was caught with a bundle of clothes and tools. He was making one last attempt to break out of prison, but he was met by amusement on the part of the guards. He was 70 years old, weak, mostly blind, with a huge hernia. Even if he made it out, how far could he get? Pomeroy died of coronary heart disease on September 29, 1932. He was 72 years old and had spent 58 years in prison. Despite a lifetime of trying, death was the only escape he ever found.
To learn more about the boy fiend, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/055. We'll have pictures of Jesse Pomeroy, his mother, and funeral pictures of his final victims. We'll also have a link to the PDF of his autobiography. I did the research for this week's show online, and it wasn't until I was wrapping up that I realized that I had read a biography of Jesse Pomeroy about 15 years ago. It was called Fiend: The Shocking True Story of America's Youngest Serial Killer. We'll link to that, and to a more recent book on Pomeroy called The Wilderness of Ruin. And, of course, we'll have links to more information on this week's featured historic site and upcoming event.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can reach us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. If you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, please think about writing us a brief review. It's still the best way to help others discover the show.
That's all for now. We'll be back in 2 weeks to talk about the 100th anniversary of the Halifax explosion and the story of Boston's official Christmas tree.